Ryan Stanton here with ASAP Frontline, joined today by Dr. James Augustine, or Jim, as I know him when we see each other at meetings around the country, shaking hands. Jim's a fantastic person and went to medical school at Wright State University School of Medicine, also residency as well at Wright State. And what we're talking about today is a special topic, and it's on the frequency that we're now seeing medication shortages in the United States. It's an important topic. We wanted to record it because of the upcoming Leadership and Advocacy Conference for the American College of Emergency Physicians. It will be one of the major issues we are talking about on Capitol Hill, and it's a growing issue that is now impacting each and every one of us on a daily basis, and I think it's something that we need to know more about, and we also need to take action for our profession, for our EMS colleagues, and as well for our patients so they can get the best care possible. And before I get with Dr. Augustine, I wanted to mention that just last night I had a patient with atrial fibrillation, elderly female, atrial fibrillation, rapid ventricular response, and typically reaching for that diltiazem to rate control, but of course that is out and we're having to turn to Esmolol, an old medication that we don't use too frequently, and to try to control. It's inferior, significantly more hypotension, and honestly didn't achieve the rate control that we wanted. So no poor outcome at this point, but I felt like an inferior approach and management strategy because of this drug shortage, and we're seeing it more often. So Dr. Augustine, talk to us about the shortages and what it means for us in emergency medicine, EMS, and our patients.
Thanks, Ryan. Appreciate being on, and thanks to everybody who's listening. This is new to me. 35 years in emergency medicine, never dealt with the issue that you had last night in the emergency department, and today I was called by one of my emergency medical service organizations who said they're out of D50, and the supplier is even running short on bags of D10. What is our next solution that we're going to use? And this is really at a point of doing patients harm. It's causing errors. It's causing a rapid rise in expense for all of the agencies that deal with emergency care. And then, like you, many providers are wondering what's the next thing that they need to use, looking up doses. The nurses are going through trying to do calculations. And so this is a crazy time in American healthcare, and particular for emergency providers.
I remember back in residency, you know, we'd occasionally have shortages, and this was 10, 12 years ago, and we'd have shortages. They last a couple of weeks. You just adjust your practice plan for a brief amount of time. Then we've had a little time where just rarely you'd have something. But over the last year or two, it seems like we've had this huge spike in shortages, and not only shortages, but shortages with no resolution timeline, nothing on the horizon for when we're going to get them back. So let's talk about why we're seeing such a huge spike right now, and what's behind all of it.
This is unprecedented, what we're dealing with now. We would have perhaps minor shortages in our earlier years, but this has been a problem that began in March of 2011, when hospitals and emergency medical services began to report on drug shortages, and I got my first questions about medication substitutions. Over the time between March of 2011 and now, so that's 7 years for me, I have been following this issue and getting regular reports on what drugs are in short supply. And this week, we are at an unprecedented level. We have 116 medication preparations in emergency care only. This isn't counting oncology and other areas. In emergency care only, 116 medication preparations that are not available, 43 additional narcotic preparations that are not available, and 50 IV fluid preparations that are not available. So it's no wonder last night when you were looking for a medication, this crosses all of our medication classes that are in our drug dispensing machines in emergency departments and in the drug kits in EMS. and we're at unprecedented levels. And unfortunately, Ryan, we don't know where this is going to stop, because the problems that have been at work and in play here are not being resolved. We get some additional issues like hurricane damage to Puerto Rico, which, really unknown to anyone in this country, was a source of many of our IV solutions and some of our medications. And all of the sourcing information is proprietary, so no one really has any idea where drugs are made. We're down to typically single suppliers for many of our medicines. And the FDA has always frowned on foreign sourcing of medications. And so we're really at the whims of the manufacturers as to which medicines might be available and what the prices might be. So back in the background of this, an ampule of 1 milligram of epinephrine used to cost about 21 cents to our emergency medical service agencies. The price as of this week is $22. 1 milligram epinephrine, 21 cents, now $22.
So we're talking about at least, you know, a hundredfold increase there. And, you know, there has to be several things that came together. I mean, is this something that a regulatory issue on the government side? You mentioned some of the, you know, weather-related stuff with Puerto Rico and things like that. But, you know, this was well going on well before then with growing numbers, and that just kind of piled on to it. Is it a regulatory issue? Is it a money issue? Is it a lawsuit issue? Why is it that we're now seeing only single suppliers of medications, when it seemed like 10 or 15 years ago, as soon as something went generic, you'd have two or three, four more companies competing for that drug market?
Yeah, I could go back and you know, many of the medicines we've used are 50 years or older. When I first started in EMS, the typical medicines we used are the same medicines we use now, with just a few additions. And most of those medicines cost pennies. The origin of this problem was somewhere in the 2009-2010 arena. There was, at that point, some extra scrutiny of quality manufacturing practices of medicines, and the FDA began to warn some of the manufacturers about issues related to manufacturing of medicines. There have, in the subsequent years, been some high-profile cases. A compounding pharmacy in New England that had a bunch of contaminated drugs go out and kill people. But for the most part, the manufacturing of our medicines, this is not complicated stuff. Salt water, sugar water, baking soda in water. This is not complicated stuff, not complicated molecules, and the manufacturing process hasn't changed much in 50 years. For some reason, in this 2009, 10, 11 arena, began to see sourcing of the medicines go to fewer manufacturers. A problem set that began to creep in terms of availability. At that point, really not big pricing changes. Then in that time frame, in DC, there were several hearings. I took place in one of those hearings where there was a discussion about why the shortage. The manufacturers talked about problems with the FDA. They also talked about problems with the big wholesalers and distributors and the pricing power of those entities, and that their pricing power was forcing the manufacturers of the medicines to go to a no-margin approach to many of these medicines. The wholesaler distributors absolutely refused that they were any part of a problem. Nonetheless, there was finger pointing that went on, and really no resolution of the base problem. Then we had a period of time where it looked like supplies were beginning to come up, and at that point was when pricing changes began to occur. And one of our medicines, which we watched go up in price pretty dramatically in that time frame, was naloxone. which at the first point that we began tracking this about 2007, for 2 milligrams was about $2. And then it doubled and tripled in price. And then as we moved into the opiate overdose time period, which Ryan, you and I both work in, the price of naloxone is now $44 for 2 milligrams. Our wake-up dose in Cincinnati, Dayton, where I work, is 6 milligrams. So the price of naloxone, the wholesale price, if you will, of naloxone for a wake-up dose is about $130. So that has occurred. And then over the last year, again, the problems have really seemed to get more pronounced. There's more finger-pointing, but no resolution. And now emergency providers are scrambling like you were last evening to try to find medicines to care for patients.
Interestingly, the FDA has its own page of frequently asked questions for the reasons for drug shortages. And, you know, they tout at the top of their infographic that they're working closely with the drug makers to remedy the issue. And like most government entities, that clearly has gotten worse. That it has better. They break down as of 2012, so this was 5 to 6 years ago when this one was actually published, 117 shortages reported at that point, and they're saying here the reasons were raw materials, 27%, and you know when you're talking about salt and baking soda and sugar, I have no idea where you find those things, and yet we can find them in every meal we have. Quality manufacturing issues, 37%. Quality delays and capacity, 27%. Loss of manufacturing site, 2%, which is probably up now with Puerto Rico being hit as hard as it was. Increased demand, 5%. And discontinuation, 2%. And, you know, the issue is here, when it was one or two drugs that I was dealing with on a daily basis, then that wouldn't be a huge deal. But right now, we did a survey on EM Docs about shortages that were impacting our providers, physicians, and other staff within the emergency department. And there's dozens of drugs every single day that are impacting the care we provide. And yet no, there is no movement other than the physicians, it seems, to address this issue with us on the front line, knowing that it's going to impact patients. It changes the way we provide care. We're not as comfortable with these medications. They're not as efficacious. There's more risk factors associated with some of these older medications. And yet it seems like so many of these groups are just pointing fingers at each other, whether it's the manufacturers, whether it's pharmaceuticals, whether it's the wholesalers, whether it's the government-based groups are pointing fingers, but nobody's really willing to fix the dang problem. Where do you see us getting a solution, and how do you see a solution to all of this growing shortage of medications that are impacting the care we provide?
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't have much of an answer except a couple of kind of management pieces at the emergency department or emergency medical services area. The hospitals, fortunately, have a bigger inventory of medicines typically, and typically the physicians and nurses have kind of a broader inventory of medicines that they're familiar enough with that they can substitute fairly frequently. Where this really becomes a problem is in emergency medical services, where we're less capable of doing that. The reason I talk about this is the first place we had to develop some management strategies was for the paramedic group working in the field. And in 2012 was when we wrote our first grid of for each of the medicines in the drug box, what is the substitute? And if there's no medicine substitute, what is the procedural substitute? We've been in a long-term shortage of atropine. Atropine has a substitution that really is not a very good one in the medication world, which is dopamine. And at that point, dopamine in the drip form was still available. And so our substitution list on our grid went, if no atropine is available, consider substitution of dopamine in a drip. And then the next substitution is really transcutaneous pacemaking. And so we we had to develop a grid for each of the medicines used in our drug box. We had some medicines where there frankly is not a substitute, and an early one for us was Mag-Sulfate for the preeclamptic / eclamptic woman who was getting into trouble. We were so short in one of the counties where I run that we had a single supply source of all the Mag-Sulfate in the county that was on one EMS supervisor's vehicle. Therefore, when a patient was identified who potentially would need that medicine, whether that lady was in the field or in the hospital, the entire county's worth of Mag-Sulfate would roll her way. And we developed a just-in-time delivery model for our medicines that were in shortage. Piece two, we had to develop substitution principles. And for example, the first form of dextrose that went out was D25, used mostly in pediatric patients. When D25 went out, we had to either develop a diluting formula for D50, or we had to substitute D10 and begin to carry bags of D10, which we had not done in the past. In the EMS world, it's easier for us to substitute a diluted form of D50. And so we came up with a formula to do that with saline drips with a mixture of D50 into those that work better for EMS. In the hospital, we would have a different type of a problem to solve, which typically would involve the nurses diluting down D50 to a D25 concentration. And then everybody having to be aware of the dosing changes and then be calculating on the fly. Third piece for the field was just-in-time training for new medicines and regulatory changes so that many states, and I think you're in one state and I work in Ohio, which has pretty strict pharmacy board requirements for carrying medicines and for substituting medicines. And so we had to go through our drug lists in each of our agencies and begin to expand what potentially was on our in our drug boxes, and then make the state and its inspectors understand that we were going to list three kinds of benzodiazepines for use in pediatric seizures. We might only have one of them in the drug box, and in any single entity, we may have drug boxes where one had had midazolam, one had diazepam, one had lorazepam, and the inspectors who would come around and look at our drug boxes very much had to understand that any drug box may contain something different, and no drug box was going to contain all three of them. With that, we had to do just-in-time training and developed text messaging approaches and just-in-time learning mechanisms for our people so that they would have comfort in understanding what medicine was being substituted. We also changed the packaging so that, for example, with the benzos, in the old days, midazolam would have been preferred medicine in a single pouch and a single place in the drug box, and it had been there for years. With the shortage, we had to develop a process of having a green baggie, if you will, which would have a sticker on it, which whatever the seizure product, whichever the sedative product we were going to use, would be in the green bag, and on the label on the green bag would have an adult and a pediatric dose on it, so that right there in the drug box, available for the paramedic, they knew if they had a child who was seizing, they would reach instead of into the single place where the midazolam always was, they would reach for the green pouch. The green pouch would have whatever product it was, and would have the appropriate dosing so that just in time they would have access to the correct information. That is the extent to which you have to change this. In the emergency department, we went to every shift information exchanges, what is available today, and Ryan, you may be having the same meetings at the beginning of your shifts where the charge nurse says, hey, today in our drug dispensing machines, we have Novodazolam. Instead, we only have Lorazepam. And the Lorazepam is in 2 milligram increment doses. The same with our narcotics, what's available today. The same with our IV fluids. Saline's not available today. Try half normal saline or convert to ringers. And then if you're going to use ringers, remember there's a few patients who can't get ringers. This is where we are now. And it's a combination of just-in-time information exchange, just-in-time education, changes in packaging so that mistakes are not made, and then a belief that we will dance through this both in the field and the emergency department so that we don't do patient harm.
Well, I think that's the biggest issue is it sounds to me with these amount of changes and shifting on the fly that this could be one of the larger patient safety concerns of this couple of years. What are your thoughts on the impact of this many changes on this many levels of the acute care side of medicine and the impact it's going to have on our patients?
Yeah. And it clearly has had impact already. We, as you know, probably need more near miss and non-judgment reporting mechanisms in our industry. And this is one of the places where we have tried to implement it so that if we have a near miss with a medication, that the paramedics will, in a no-fault system, be able to report to us, hey, I was, reaching for the medicine, we're short on something, I picked something out, I almost injected this patient with the medicine that might have harmed them. I want you to be aware of that. And then with the QI process that's in place, we could go through and say, hey, that could happen to any of us. Look at the packaging on this and then develop better labeling systems or a better marking system somehow so that that does not occur. We've had expiration date changes, and Ryan, this is interesting. So we've been told for all of our years the expiration dates are firm, but then a year ago, one of the manufacturers said for our most common medicines that are very stable in the drug boxes or in the hospitals, so that is atropine, D50, epinephrine, and another medicine I'm slipping the name on. But anyway, for any of those medicines, we're going to extend the expiration date by a year for these lots. So then we had to go through all the lots, make sure that the expiration date, and then we would have to somehow note for the paramedics and for any pharmacist who's checking our drug boxes that an expiration date extension for this lot of medicines had taken place by the manufacturer, and we were keeping this medicine in place and available for patient care, even though it was beyond the manufacturer's posted expiration date on the drug container or on the box that it was in. So that is a change, and another thing that has to be trained on and QI'd on and followed very closely. You have to know how to check lot numbers and do verification of lot numbers. So that's where we are in the system. Clearly, again, time-consuming, fraught with potential areas for error, the nurses having to use medicines that they don't typically use, and probably in your experience again last night, you're pulling out a medicine that the nurses aren't used to using all the time. They know the dose of adenosine really well, but now they're in a beta blocker, and it's in different packaging, and they don't pull that out so frequently. So you're probably there doing a just-in-time a piece of education with the nurses to make sure that the proper dose is given. I was going to take one more step, which is the poor patients. And the shortage of critical medicines like EpiPens really has been very difficult for patients and forced us to do completely different education of patients. And so you have somebody who has a history of anaphylaxis, you would like to give them an EpiPen prescription, but you know it's not available. And frequently we would give EpiPen prescriptions. The family would take that script to the pharmacy and then realize that it was a $400 charge or higher for the dose of epinephrine. They couldn't afford that. Can we give them a substitute? Well, no, we can't. There is no substitute. And so here we have a compromise of what the patient and the family are able to do for themselves. And then you have to educate them instead. Okay, you can't find an EpiPen. You can't find an EpiPen Junior. Instead, if your child gets stung or eats the food that they're allergic to, instead of administering the medicine, you're going to have to call EMS. EMS is going to have to respond. EMS may have to sit there with the patient for some time to observe them because, you know, maybe them getting stung this time didn't produce an anaphylactic reaction. But if you have no EpiPen in the hands of the family, then you have to have the EpiPen or the Epi dosing available from EMS. And so that's entirely different education and really compromises the discussion that takes place with the patient and their family. Thank you for letting me state that.
No, I completely agree. And we're seeing that with more and more stuff. I mean, even with the simple as albuterol, one that we've seen a few years ago that went from a generic few dollar prescription to one that's at least $40 a pop and around here, you know, and you're in the same way with practice in Ohio, is that we have this population, a significant number of population, that's just not a conceivable dollar amount. And there is no adequate coverage to cover that. And, you know, as we're sitting here talking about, the reason this is an important conversation, the reason we're having this conversation and we're doing this over the phone, and is because this is going to be one of the big pushes for the American College of Emergency Physicians at Leadership and Advocacy in 2018. And actually, that's when we're going to release this here in a couple of weeks. And, you know, it's a big push. It's on the radar. And I think a lot of it's this huge disconnect. I mean, just sitting here while you're talking, looking at this infographic from the FDA, and if you can look at it for yourself out there, if you're listening, it's the FDA.gov, so www.fda.gov/drug shortages. They're touting all of the successes that they've made, with 2016 only having 23 all-form shortages and 17 injectable shortages, and how much they've averted, and yet our EM Docs poll has 52 drugs and drug families listed, and that's just a quick poll involving around 600 to 800 ER physicians from around the country. So appears to be this huge disconnect between, you know, what's being seen on the federal level and what we are seeing on the actual action level, the providing of care level and the life-saving level. And, you know, where groups think they're making huge progress from a federal standpoint, you know, we're just seeing just the opposite, with numbers growing exponentially. And I do believe that I saw a decrease for a while, for a few years, but now those numbers are higher than I've ever seen them before. And not just higher in terms of number of drugs that are missing, but instead of 10 years ago, or even just 8 to 10 years ago, when we were seeing shortages for 1 to 2 weeks, we're seeing shortages on drugs with no known recovery date, meaning we have to have a long-term replacement solution because there's no horizon for that medication anymore. Is that something that you're seeing when you're looking at these shortages, that more and more of these medications don't have an outlook for being back in supply?
Yes, sir, Ryan, and thanks for sharing that and looking at that infographic. It does give you the impression that this problem is coming under control, when in fact we're not seeing that. So a week ago, I sent you the report on the drug shortage. For the last 5 years or so, every week on Monday, a report is produced by one of the larger wholesaler distributors of medicines. And it is a de facto shortage list because it's what is not available for them to purchase to fulfill customer requests for medicines. Ryan, as you and I looked at that together last week, again, this is emergency medicine specific. And there's 116 preparations, which has in some way all of our very favorite medicines on it. And then what has ramped up over the last couple weeks really has been the narcotic shortages, which some believe are related to the feeling that there's just too many narcotics available on the street, which shutting off the therapeutic doses of opiate pain medicines to the emergency community, to me, is just an irresponsible strategy, and in no way solves the problem of fentanyl overdoses and illicit drug issues. Nonetheless, there are 43 of those preparations that are not available, and then all of our favorite IV fluids are on this list. The frustrating part, as you pointed out, is as you look at this list, the growing date where there's anticipated manufacturing of this medicine is it gets longer and longer, and now many of these medicines with indefinite dates for being released and available for the customers. Again, even our simplest medicines, lidocaine, many preparations of lidocaine are on this list. Many people are using ketamine, and ketamine is on this list, originally slated to be back available in April of 2019, which is right now. Now it's being pushed back to June 2019, with the potential that it won't be available then either. Ondansetron, which was off for a while, is back on this. Sodium bicarbonate is prominent on this. And just some simple other medicines, thiamine, our tetracaine. This is crazy. These are really simple medicines available for a long time at very low expense, and now they're not available to us.
It may be to the point that, you know, especially with opioids, it seems like China is able to provide plenty for our streets for our heroin. So, you know, we may end up just having to hire them to start actually making stuff for the hospital as well, if we can somehow convince them to slip atropine and lidocaine and things like that into the drugs. We can maybe actually have a source for those. I mean, it's super frustrating from a physician standpoint. And, you know, I imagine that from a medical legal risk standpoint, there's not going to be any parlay because we didn't have what we thought we were going to do and there's a bad outcome. I mean, what's my defense going to be? It's, I'm sorry, I didn't have that. I can't help, or I can't do anything about this. And we are going to get to that point that there's going to be a significant enough shortage that there's going to be a patient or patients come into the emergency department or in EMS that we cannot address their problem because we have no medication able to address it. You know, once we get two or three generations down the priority chart, but it's, you know, there's, you get to the point that you're just not going to have something. And, you know, we're just going to have to look at the person and say, I cannot help you, can't do anything about it. Basically turning a first world medicine into a third world medical problem. And I think it's big that we, as a college and as profession, tackle this and get all over that. And so it is, we'll be one of the things we're really pushing in Washington, D.C., hopefully opening up some eyes to the problem that's going on to some of the policymakers out there. And maybe if somebody can crack the thick skull of the FDA and say that, you know, your infographic is a bunch of junk, that this problem is growing exponentially to the point that it's going to harm patients, what can all of our listeners, because not all of them are going to be in Washington, D.C. With us, how can they help address this issue and help to make changes and open the eyes of those that could push change?
Yeah, this clearly is a federal level problem. So for the most part, local knowledge and local political action will not be beneficial. So any issues that are related to the political side of this really have to go straight to the federal level. This then would go to your federal House of Representative or Senator and let them know how this impacts you at the local level and the substitutions that you're making and that the compromise in patient care occurs. As you and I both know, it's always best to put this in the patient's words. And so in our discussion, we've always asked our patients, the ones who don't have EpiPens, the ones that can't afford their albuterol inhaler, the ones that didn't get any pain medicine because there was no pain medicine available. Those are the people that you would like to have talk to the politicians in D.C. Again, we've had hearings. This has been put in front of the FDA. A month ago, we had another discussion with members of the FDA. We've had discussions with ASPR and Department of Health and Human Services to see if there's anything from their side that they could do to influence the availability of medications by putting pressure on manufacturers. The federal side to this is really where the action is going to have to take place. There's a couple things, though, that people have to do near their home. Number one, the state pharmacy boards, I just can't believe, aren't taking any action in regard to this. We have had no help from our state pharmacy boards in any of the states where I practice when it comes to coming up with solutions, alternatives, guidance, et cetera. So it's been the Emergency Medical Services Board that has had to come up with the answers for some pieces to this. In some states, for example, they have substituted epinephrine kits for epinephrine pens, so that you have a simple substitution process of a 0.5 cc syringe, a 1 milligram dose of epinephrine, an alcohol prep pad, and it's all placed in a little Ziploc baggie with instructions for what to do for an adult and a child in the event of an anaphylactic reaction, that you can use this medicine. So that then you have a $25 kit that is available instead of a $400 pen that may not even be available, or the pen that is only available in the adult size when you need it for the pediatric patient. That is something that you have at the state level that can assist you. At the local level, everything we can do to share short medicines to make sure that whatever is available to us that we make use of before the expiration date is really important. So sharing amongst hospitals and amongst emergency medical services has really become an important way to preserve whatever supplies are available. I mentioned one way of doing this, which was, you can't do this with controlled substances, but we have a substance that isn't controlled that is critically important and that there really is no substitute for. And we developed a county-wide distribution process that crossed over both EMS and the hospitals. We have developed the change in EMS protocols that have to be shared across all the entities within your local area. So that's either region or county or city jurisdiction. We have purchasing co-ops that if any drug is available, what we can get our hands on and can make use of best, again, across wherever it might be needed, making use of those purchasing co-ops to be able to do that. And again, exchanging it so that as a medicine gets close to its expiration date, it is put in the place where it is most likely to be used rather than going to expiration and having to be tossed away. There's storage, there's labeling, and other things that all have to be done locally. And then whatever education process goes on, Ryan, your first point here, you know, we have a problem with the medicine available to take care of a specific cardiac problem. That's a crossover for the hospital and EMS. Then we develop one learning platform that goes for the ED nurses and for the paramedics. We're doing a substitute medication, and here it is, here's how we use it, here's the usual doses, here are the unusual precautions that we take with this medicine, and make that education available for physicians, ED nurses, and for the paramedics who might have to use it. So those are all the pieces to this, local, state, national, but this is, again, a manufacturing problem. It is a federal oversight of that. States and local areas have no oversight under the manufacturers. Some of this is pricing, and you got to go back and think of your budgets. And then it's whatever influence we can get at the federal level. Long answer. I apologize.
No, great information. And for many or hundreds of your ER physician, EM physician colleagues will be in Washington, D.C. in May, with this being one of their major topics from our EM Docs poll, which I posted 7 days ago. So 1 week, we've got 52 52 drug shortages reported, or classes reported by about 600 to 700 physicians. Number one shortage that we're noticing, boots on the ground, is an opioid of any type, so a broad topic there. Diltiazem, number two. Diazepam, number three. Lidocaine with epi, number four. And saline is number five, followed right behind that by certain IV bags to put them in. So, you know, those are all things we're seeing. It's going to impact our patients. And another reason we as emergency physicians have to be the advocates for our patients, because unfortunately, many times their voices and individual lives go unnoticed and silenced. Unfortunately, what tends to make action is a politician's family member or a famous person's family member or themselves having a significant poor outcome. But we can collect those stories and start to bring those to our legislators, contacting them and letting them know how this is impacting the care that we are providing in the emergency department. Dr. James Augustine, emergency physician, very active in this. We appreciate your help and glad that we were able to connect. So this will be ready for our trip to Washington, D.C. coming up here very shortly. How can folks get in touch with you if they have more questions, contacts, things like that, whether it's social media or whatnot?
Yeah, and thank you. And thanks for your work in disseminating this information and doing the poll and making this real for both our practitioners and our patients. And my contact information, James Augustine, that is jaugustine@usacs.com, usacs.com. And I'm glad to answer any questions. And if there's any references that I have, I'm glad to share those with anyone. The voice of the patient, really, really critical. The voice of the paramedic, too. And you got to think these poor guys, you know, are out in the streets, used to use it in medicine. Now we're changing everything up on them and making life difficult. And then they don't feel comfortable giving a medicine to a patient because they're confused about what's in the bag. So there's a patient being transported without care being delivered because we've made them nervous doing all these medication changes on them. So there's a number of implications of that. And can you imagine how any of us would feel if we made a mistake? We're used to using a medicine. We try to substitute some. A mistake is made. You might end somebody's career over something like that. And we don't want to see the impacts like that. So we have to do our local, regional, national impact actions in order to try to preserve ourselves and preserve our environment.
Dr. Augustine, thank you so much for your time. Great conversation and great information. It is definitely something that we all need to be involved with when it comes to advocating for our profession and for our patients to provide the best possible care at every single situation, especially in acute care situations with EMS and emergency medicine. As for me, you can contact me at youreverydaymedicine@gmail.com. That's youreverydaymedicine@gmail.com. Make sure that you are subscribed to the podcast and a friend.